We voted for a government that would protect us, but voted in a government that gave us the Monsanto Protection Act. This act of government leads us to ask, what's to eat in the Monsanto Protection Act?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 924th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. Well, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Dave, what do you get to eat from the Monsanto Protection Act?
I don't even know what the Monsanto Protection Act is.
Stay tuned. Also with us today, producer Kelly Bayo. Kelly, what do you get to eat from the Monsanto Protection Act?
I don't even know what you mean, Michael.
Then stay tuned. We got some learning to do. Folks, they say there are two sides to every story. And what they say is most certainly true when it comes to the story of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. There is the side of the producer and the side of the consumer. Let's begin with a producer side and a very simple fact. The technology of genetic engineering has made growing food crops much easier. Before GMOs, a farmer had to go out into the fields and cull weeds and pests by hand and machine. Tough work, as anyone who has worked the fields under a hot summer sun can attest. Technology has allowed companies like Monsanto to re-engineer the genes of plants so those plants can withstand herbicides and contain pesticides. And thus one farmer can now grow thousands of acres of crops with no weeds or bugs. To the producer, GMOs make work easier and more profitable, and that is a fact. Now let's turn to the other side of the story and ask, what does the consumer get with GMOs? The simple fact is, most consumers never ask the question. They simply eat what's in the package and go their way. But for a significant number of other consumers, there is uncertainty with respect to the efficacy of eating foods that have been saturated in herbicides and infused with pesticides, and they have taken to resisting the spread of GMO crops across the land. To resist this consumer resistance, the biotech industry worked with government to enact a farmer assurance provision that, in essence, restricted the consumer's right to petition the courts to stop the planting of GMOs. Seeing the GMOs being placed above the law, as it were, consumers renamed the government's provision the Monsanto Protection Act. Thus, we have two sides to our story. For the producer, the farmer assurance provision. For the consumer, it's the Monsanto Protection Act. And so these two sides present us with some very interesting questions. And we're going to ask them today. They are, why did government enact a farmer assurance provision? A farmer assurance provision. Think of it. What else are we going to do but assure farmers that they can grow crops? How did the farmer assurance provision become the Monsanto Protection Act? And finally, what's to eat in the Monsanto Protection Act? Well, here to help us find some answers, we have a very special guest from the beautiful state of North Dakota. He is a corn farmer, a North Dakota state senator, and by golly, a pundit, Terry Wanzek. Did I get the last name right, Terry?
It's Wanzek.
Wanzek. Well, thank you very much for joining us today from North Dakota.
No, my pleasure.
We're happy to hear that you got your seeds into the ground. Now, that's a very special feeling for all farmers everywhere. Tell us a little bit about what you felt when you finally got the seeds in the ground and could relax for a moment.
Well, I felt relief and joy. It's been a long, arduous spring planting season. You know, it started off pretty good, but we have hit some unprecedented wet weather, and it's been raining off and on for quite some time. And actually, this is later, quite a bit later than normal for planting our crop. But so so it was a relief to finally be done. We're getting to the point where our growing season is short, and we're getting to the point where planting and pretty soon will not be an option.
So you got your seeds into the ground, and there's a, you know, this funny thing about farming. There's this thing called nature, and the nature never quite behaves like you want it to, right?
That's correct. Well, I've been farming 30 plus years. 1975, when I was in high school, I started with renting some of my uncle's ground, and so I've been doing it for a long time. And I got to say, just about every single year shows me something new with nature.
And thus, you know, after a long winter and the anticipation and the buying of seeds and the waiting for the weather, and finally you get into the ground and you're a farmer with crops in the ground now. Now, the rest of the year, right?
Right.
And then what comes of that? Well, we're really happy to have you aboard today, but I have to ask you, what do you enjoy most, being a farmer, being a state senator, or being a pundit?
Absolutely, without hesitation, being a farmer. I'm absolutely convinced my part-time job as a citizen legislator confirms with me that I chose the right path in being a farmer. That is my passion. That is what I am. That's who I identify with. I'm a fourth generation. It's in my blood. I grow crops and produce food for the rest of the world.
Well, we're especially happy to have you here, Terry, today to discuss this particularly contentious issue that, I don't know, how come it became so contentious? What do you think?
I can't explain why it's become contentious. I don't see it contentious at all. As a matter of fact, you know, for a lot of people, I want them to understand, I was not involved in writing the provision. I'm a state legislator. You cannot believe how many times I get asked, when are you going back to Washington? I'm not going back to Washington. I'm a state legislator. I did not write it, but from my understanding, it basically respects and honors a farmer's decision when they make a decision based on legal, regulatory approval, and based on the facts of being presented with a legal product, they make a decision to plant. It guarantees them the opportunity to finish that job and harvest their crop.
Mm-hmm. And this is a 6-month provision, correct?
6-month provision, from what I understand. And I understand it's been existing law since the 2010 Supreme Court ruling. It really has, I can't quite understand why it's become called the Monsanto Protection Act. It has nothing to do with Monsanto. It has everything to do with producers being protected in the sense that you make a decision based on the facts, a good faith decision based on the facts and the legal environment at the time to plant a crop. Farming is a marathon. I've always told my brother, it's not a sprint. You know, you make decisions today that impact you a year from now, and you make those decisions, and it's guaranteeing the farmer the fact that if he made that decision based in good faith on legal environment that was at the current time he made those decisions, that allowed him to do it. I'm not condoning any illegal activity here, to be certain that folks understand that. That he's allowed to finish the job. And that's all it simply is. And I'm really kind of struggling with how anybody cannot see the fairness in that.
Well,
it's just like you, if you were to purchase your iPhone, purchase modern technology that a lot of people have today, pay the contract fee, buy the phone, and then have somebody come forward and claim without any scientific proof that it using your phone causes radiation and cancer, they take it away from you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like being in a fast-moving stream, and they take away your paddle. You know, I don't see how anybody cannot see the fairness in that when it comes to farming. And making that statement, setting that precedent, at least allows that farmer to be compensated if it should be identified later that there is some concern with it and it needs to be removed that farmer can be assured of some sort of compensation for his investment effort and his efforts.
And that's why they call it the Farmer Assurance Act, right?
That's correct. It's totally, from what I understand, focused on protecting the farmer.
Okay, when we come, we're going to have to take a quick break, Terry, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you how the technology, biotech technology, has changed your business of farming and the difference it has made to your growing and why you're growing corn now instead of wheat and all kinds of fun things up there in North Dakota.
Okay.
Have you ever heard anybody call North Dakota beautiful before?
Certainly. I think it's very beautiful. I think our state is, in many ways, is misunderstood or misconceived. It's a very beautiful state with a lot of good
friendly
people.
Right back. Do stay tuned, folks. Terry Wancik and you.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're picking up the Farmer Assurance Provision, an act put into play by the federal government that essentially assures farmers the right to grow there are crops, even though some people think those crops might not be safe and try to stop them or prevent them from growing that crop. The Farmer Assurance Provision says that they can continue to grow that crop, and that's that. Essentially, I think, placing that crop above or beyond the reach of the law or a civil authority. And so that is the question today, is essentially, what did agriculture try to accomplish in doing this? I'd like to start a little bit by talking with Terry Wancik about how biotechnology has changed his business of growing crops. And Terry's been in business long enough to know, right, Terry?
That's correct. I'm 56 years old. My first crop was in 1975, as I said, with Voag, Future Farmers of America.
Wait a minute. Terry, did you hoe weeds out in the hot summer sun?
Yes, I have.
So have I. So we know what it was like to hoe weeds in the hot summer sun.
I often think of that when I hear people opposing some of this technology. I wonder how many of them have really ever had to grow a crop, have had to make a profit doing it, and have had to grow a crop. Till they've been in my shoes, I don't take them too serious.
Yeah. So tell us how this technology has changed your business.
Let me start by, here's one way that I've often shared with others. You know, you go to the National Ag Statistical Services, the USDA data and census statistics page, and you can look up county by county. And you take our county in 1996, right about the time these biotech crops were coming into the scene, and our county grew 451,000 acres of wheat in Stutsman County, according to the National Ag Statistical Service. And this last year, in 2012, we grew 73,000. So we've dropped more than 370-some thousand acres in wheat. We grew 2,600 acres of soybeans in our county in 1996. 19,000 acres of corn, most of the crops that have the technology in them today. And today, we're growing 414,000 acres of soybeans in our county, and we're growing 213,000 acres of corn. Mm-hmm. Barley, which does not have the technology, went from 70-some thousand 77,000 down to 14,000.
But what is it about the technology that has so changed your business?
To me, the technology has allowed us to reduce our fossil fuel usage. Mm-hmm. We do a lot less trips over the field. We requires a lot less tractor and tillage use, which is very costly.
Why does it require less? What about the technology that made that change? What changed for you?
The technology allows you to control weeds, no different than we did before using pesticides. It has allowed us to, one issue I'd take up, I think I looked at your site the other day, and I've heard you mention in your prelude here that we, you know, some consumers are concerned about the heavy use of pesticides. It's actually allowed us to reduce our pesticide use. And it's because of Roundup, which in my mind is a much friendlier pesticide. It has no residual value. Matter of fact, a North Dakota State weed scientist told me one time that it essentially breaks down the minute it hits soil and becomes nothing more than a sugar.
So for people who do not know, then, what we're talking about here, by genetically reengineering the corn plant to be able to be sprayed with Roundup, it doesn't hurt the corn plant.
Right.
Because we have reengineered the plant so that it is not affected.
It has a resistance to the Roundup.
So you can spray the Roundup on the field, and it kills all the weeds.
Which also allows us to do minimum tillage, leaving much more residue out there for wildlife. It conserves a lot more moisture. We're utilizing the water more efficiently in our production. It all around has made us much more productive. It has enhanced our yields, increasing our yields. One thing I think people need to truly understand, farmers voluntarily plant these crops. Mm-hmm. They're not somehow subverted by the Monsantos of the world. They make a conscious economic decision, and they have, probably more so than any other agricultural technology, have adopted this technology at a faster rate because they see the benefits.
Sure. One benefit is that it's resistant to glyphosate or Roundup. Right. The other benefit is that by reengineering the plant, you can have that plant be infused with Bacillus thuringiensis pesticide.
Right, right.
So that,
which I understand many, it's a natural protein or whatever, which many organic producers spray on their crop.
That's correct.
And it is used to control corn borer and rootworm. So there again, we're using less insecticide to control those insect pests.
So, in effect, if a bug bites any part of the corn plant, the Bacillus thuringiensis enters its digestive tract and blows up the stomach.
It has natural immunity in a sense.
So then,
it naturally resists it, and it allows us to eliminate one insecticide or pesticide application.
So then, here one farmer then can plant like 1,000 acres of crops. And do it without having any weeds, and do it without having any pests. And if that isn't a big deal, I don't know what is. That seems like it's about the biggest deal in the history of agriculture.
You know, when I think of when I grew up and went to K through 12 education, I often remember studying history and learning about Eli Whitney and the cotton gin and how it impacted agriculture, John McCormick, the moldboard plow, how it all historically changed agriculture. I think this, I'm absolutely certain in the future, will be identified as one of those technologies that dramatically impacted, in my work, in my opinion, positively, the production of agricultural products and food.
And anybody who's hoed weeds for days on end in the hot summer sun would probably agree with you. Oh, my goodness, this is a truly magnificent technology. And from the production side, who can argue?
That's right. And there's a consumer side. I don't disconnect like a lot of people do, the consumer side and the production side.
Well, before we go there, what is the objection then? What was agriculture trying to do by working with government to affect this Farmer Assurance Act? producer Kelly Bayer here is going, what the heck is that?
Well, again, I mean, doesn't it make sense to the average citizen out there or average person listening that if you make a decision based on the current law, based on the current approvals and deregulation, and you go ahead and plant a crop, again, farming is a long-term, it's a marathon, like I've always told my brother. You know, you sprint, you take off sprinting, you're going to burn out fast. But it's a marathon. You make decisions today that impact what happened, what you do a year or 2 years from now. So you make that decision. You make a huge investment, and you have already got it in the ground. There's no way you can go back and dig the seeds out. There's no way you can, you know, anybody understands farming. Our income comes annually.
Was somebody telling you to take your seeds out of the ground?
No, but say somebody puts an injunction on your crop and you've made the investment. There's nothing, I'm at that point, I can't really make a U-turn and do something else to recoup my investment.
And thus the Farmer Assurance Act says that, by golly, once I planted my crop, I'm assured of the ability to grow my crop. Fair enough?
Yeah, and I think you need to understand by making that statement, if the one myth that I think is out there, that there cannot be any legal...
Hey, we have to take a break. Can you hold that if?
Sure.
Ifs always hold audience, and that's exactly what we want to do, because this is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson with Terry Ranczak, who is a corn farmer, a North Dakota state senator, a pundit in the Wall Street Journal, and our guest today. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Join us. Well, you probably heard of the Farmer Assurance Act, and you probably heard of the Monsanto Protection Act. Well, turns out they're both the same thing, as seen from others, two sides of the story. One side being the side of the producer, who sees the act as a farmer assurance provision. Once we decide to make a decision to plant a crop and we buy the seed and the seed is legal, then we should be assured of the ability to be able to finish that crop. The other side, not so sure. And so, Terry, you had a big if for us. What is that big if?
Well, the big if is if a farmer plants that crop in good faith based on the current regulations and the current law, the Secretary of State still has a Secretary of Agriculture still has emergency authority under Section 414 of the Plant Protection Act to remove a product, biotech trait, if there's a risk to human or plant health. And also the EPA and the FDA still have power to remove or recall a product if there's scientific evidence to prove that there is some harm or it is indicated. And also it does not preclude or does not prohibit someone's right to challenge the determination in a court of law. It still is allowed to be done. However, by making that statement as a producer, it sets a precedent that makes a statement that I, as a producer, if there is something identified for and it's scientific and it's proven that there's a new concern and it is scientifically proven, then they can take steps to prevent that crop from being harvested. But by having that statement, producers like myself will be compensated. I mean, it's
by
establishing.
Whom?
Well, it'd have to be within the court of law. I'm sure the court would determine that. But it at least establishes the fact that I, as a producer, made this decision in good faith. Mm-hmm. And I should, you know, I'm making a long-term commitment here.
Sure.
I don't understand the many people don't understand the kind of investment it takes to plant a crop. And you don't get your return right away. Again, it's an annual return or biannual return. It takes time to get your return, and you can't just unplant a crop. You know, it's protecting the producer. It's meant to protect.
It's assuring.
I don't understand how people have misconstrued that into being a protection for Monsanto.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about now. So, but from the producer's side, it's an assurance that once you make a decision.
In good faith.
In good faith.
I want to make that clear.
Okay, good enough. So, yeah. I In considering this issue, I went to the internet and did a search for farmer assurance provision, and there are 107,000 references to the farmer assurance provision. And then I searched for the Monsanto Protection Act, and there are 5,600,000 references to the Monsanto Protection Act, which means that 52, you know, the Monsanto Protection Act is recognized 52 times more than the Farmer Assurance Act.
So, I have a view on that.
Well, how is it that something that was designed to assure farmers so frightened the bejesus out of the consumers that they simply changed the name of it?
You know, these comments might be viewed by some as confrontational or divisive or contentious. They're not meant to be. This is my take, my personal opinion. But there's a large segment of the anti-modern agriculture, anti-biotech crowd that, in my opinion, you could probably put them in the Occupy Wall Street crowd. You know, they have a penchant or an unhealthy dislike for free enterprise and capitalism. They have a hatred for American corporations, and it's a lot easier to forward their agenda and to demonize Monsanto than it is to demonize an American farmer. And, you know, they don't understand. And I said it earlier, us farmers voluntarily make the decision to plant products that companies like Monsanto, not just Monsanto, Dow Chemical, Pioneer Seed, a number of them produce because they have, you know, shown us to be beneficial in the production of food. I have a feeling these people, their agenda is more of an anti-capitalistic free market system and a hatred for corporations. So they right away migrate to this is a Monsanto Protection Act. It's a lot easier to charge up folks and get them all worked up over attacking Monsanto than it is attacking grassroots.
I got to hand it to you there. I gave a presentation at the biotech convention in Chicago a few weeks ago, and you know, there were some very intelligent people sitting on that panel with me. I guess I was the exception to the rule. But at any rate, you know, in talking with them, I made the comment that Monsanto is a very convenient evil corporation. And they have a way of helping everybody, the opposition's hand, by appearing to be that way. And one of the things that happened with respect to this farmer assurance provision is that it was kind of snuck through in the dead of night, as it were, without anybody having any comment on it in the agricultural committees in Congress or anything. It just popped up in a continuing appropriations bill. If we don't vote on this bill, the government will go bankrupt and we'll all starve to death kind of bill. So,
well, it's my understanding that's not necessarily true. That's a myth as well. And, you know, I understand many, many agricultural groups that represent folks like me, like the American Soybean Association, the Corn Growers Association, the Cotton Council, the Wheat Growers, the Farmer Co-ops, the Seed Trade Association, the American Farm Bureau Federation all supported this. And I understand it was drafted over 9 months ago and was included in consideration in the House Agricultural Spending Bill. And it was openly debated and passed by both House Agricultural Appropriations subcommittees. I understand that's not quite the case. And I understand from what I've talked to some of my friends in our delegation for North Dakota that it really wasn't that contentious or wasn't believed to be that contentious because it actually is existing law. It's codifying existing law.
Then do you think that agriculture probably could have done a little bit better if it presented this to consumers or at least
One criticism I would make of my side, we're not always the best at communicating to the general public or consumers our story. And I think we have a tremendous story, but part of the reason is folks like me, salt of the earth, grassroots farmers like me, are working our butts off planting our crop and working. We don't have time to protest and to be activists in that sense. We're very busy people, and we're doing what we believe is honorable work on a moral high ground, you know, and companies like Monsanto, companies like John Deere Corporation, companies like Caterpillar.
Well, Terry, we all agree that from the producer's side, this is great technology. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to get to, and I guess the next question that we're going to bring up when we get back from the break, is what's in the Monsanto Protection Act or the Farmers Assurance Act for consumers? Do stay tuned, right back. Well, folks, there are two sides to every story. And the story we're talking about today is the story of genetically modified crops, specifically corn, soybeans out there in the heartland of the United States of America. Today we have a heartland farmer with us to talk about that. His side of the story, at least the producer's side, Terry Wenzik, who is a farmer, corn farmer, why not wheat, Terry? North Dakota
was
very famous.
I was going to correct you on that. I'm more than a corn farmer. I'm a soybean farmer, a wheat farmer. We grow dry edible beans. We market a lot of them to Mexico and local canners. But also over the years, I've grown barley. I've grown a number of other crops, but mostly corn, soybeans, wheat, and pinto beans currently.
So corn, there's another piece in the Wall Street Journal, I guess it was yesterday or something like that. Corn is selling for, you can make about $126 an acre from corn, only $65 an acre from wheat. So that's why everybody's growing corn, right?
Yeah, that's the market is telling us to grow corn over these past few years. And, you know, that's a average or a rule of thumb number, you know.
Sure,
everybody's
sure.
A little different.
Sure, sure. Now, is that disparity have anything to do with the ethanol mandate from the federal government?
Well, you know, that I know that's used a lot too, but I don't necessarily agree with that 100%. Certainly ethanol has created a demand for our corn, but you know, a certain percentage of that corn is still used for feed as a distiller's product after the energy's been taken out of it. There's a high protein feed product to feed the livestock, so it still is providing to our food availability here in this country, in the sense that it's being used to feed the livestock.
There you go. Now, I guess the question I want to ask you, and this is the question I asked in Chicago at Biotech, and I understand, you know, having been raised on a farm in Montana and having hoed, you know, weeds in the heat of a summer, I understand how precious this new technology is for producers. And it truly is. And if people don't understand that, you know, if those people who are condemning biotech don't understand how precious this technology is, then you're only, you know, getting one side of the story. But then they have a side of the story too, and their side of the story, you know, they don't really see what's in biotech for them. What's in the Monsanto Protection Act to eat?
Well, first of all, my first reaction is, since when did a plentiful supply of safe, abundant, affordable food not benefit the consumer? I don't understand how a consumer cannot see the benefits in that. You know, I think in our country, the American farmer has been so productive and so successful that people take their food for granted. And now, I don't dismiss their concern. I understand their concern for food safety, and they have every right to be concerned about the fact that their food, the food they're eating, is safe. And I believe it is. And I believe we have a great regulatory environment that makes sure that it's safe. And I, as a farmer, I'm a father. I just found out the other day I'm going to be a grandfather.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm the fourth generation. My fifth generation is out of college, and they're at the farm, and they're starting to take over. So I have a lot of concern for my family and what they eat and what they drink. So I need people to understand that. But the fact is that, and I lost track here where I was going.
Let me ask you this, Terry. You see the products of your field as being safe, and I'm certain that you do. Consumers out here who live in the city and have lost their connection, essentially, with how food is grown.
I regained my train of thought.
Just let me finish. What they see are conflicting reports as to the efficacy of genetically modified crops. They see some studies that say, hey, these are very safe. They see other studies that say, goodness sakes, they're not safe. They're causing lesions in pig stomachs, and they're doing this, and they're destroying rats, and they're doing this. Just a minute, let me finish. Okay. And then they say, well, which one is real? And then they don't really know. But then they look to the federal government and see that the federal government's Food and Drug Administration is essentially being administered by a former vice president of Monsanto. And they say, well, who am I going to believe here?
Mm-hmm.
So what do they get? What do consumers get?
It's understandable why they would feel that way. I mean, I don't understand, and I'm not knowledgeable about every facet of our life. But I guess my view is I certainly don't believe if there is a recognized scientific risk there, I do not believe our government would approve it, first of all. And if there was any risk to health, human health, I don't believe that would happen. Also, the fact that they've been consuming these products for the past, 16 years. And there's not one documented case or evidence of anybody, of it being, a risk to anybody. And part of my concern is I know they, and I understand their right to be concerned about the safety of their food, but do they ever think about the availability of their food or the affordability of their food? And I earlier talked about meeting Dr. Borlaug. I mean, there are national societies in our history that have starved to death, basically, because they ran out of food.
Can you hold that, and we'll bring up the whole notion of the Green Revolution and the availability of food and the quality of that food when we get back.
Quality and affordability.
This is the Food Chain, right back. Well, so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in. Terry, when's that farmer from North Dakota, grows lots of crops up there, once did a live show from the Phil and Barbara Hamburger farm. I think it was in South Dakota, though, but it was such a beautiful farm, and they grew, like you do, Terry, lots of crops.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this, it was really interesting because I was up in their office, and their office kind of looked like the bridge of an aircraft carrier overlooking the sea of crops out there. It was so magnificent, and it must be a magnificent feeling to be out there in on the land and watching the crops grow and knowing that if everything works out and if nature is kind, you're going to be able to harvest a crop and earn a living.
Yep, it's a wonderful, it's hard to explain, lifestyle. And yet you're constantly around life and living things, and you see new life every spring and harvest every fall. And I love wheat harvest. It's one of the more beautiful times of the year with golden wheat fields. And it's hard to explain to people who have not ever experienced it.
Well, let me be a little cruel here for a minute, Terry.
Sure.
And let me take Terry Wenzek off of his little piece of paradise and transport him into Minneapolis and give him a job as an accountant and working for some big firm and sitting in a box.
I actually did that. I majored in accounting. I worked in Riverside, California, when I first got out of college. So.
And no wonder you're back in North Dakota. Okay. But at any rate, you're in this office, and you have no knowledge of where the food comes from or how it comes from.
Right.
And you pick up this article, and it says Scientists say new study shows pig health hurt by GMO feed. And you read this and go, I don't know about this. What's to eat in this Monsanto Protection Act for me? Terry Winzek, accountant in Minneapolis, what is in the GMO foods for you?
I guess as I think about it, I've often asked others, why is it there's this romanticism for the way my grandfather used to farm? We don't necessarily accept that in medicine. We accept modern medicine. Mm-hmm. We accept modern technology.
Some people accept modern medicine.
Yeah, some people. But the majority do. Mm-hmm. There's always a few rebels in whatever segment of life you're talking about. But I always have a hard time understanding why folks don't understand that agriculture advances also. And that's what's sustainable. Mm-hmm. We have a pretty prominent organic producer that farms next to us. He had to sell his land. He wasn't making it, and farmers like me bought it last fall. Mm-hmm. And, it's about being sustainable. And I guess my...
Well, that's good for you. That's good for you, Terry, the producer.
Yeah.
What about Terry, the accountant consumer?
Well, I would hopefully tell him, 90% of your food is grown by family farms like myself. People who, I have no desire to grow something that's going to harm you in any way. And if it is, if it's indicated that it is going to do that, I wouldn't grow that crop. I have a sense of responsibility, and I take a position of honor in a sense that I'm growing food for other people.
And knowing that, I am sure that Terry Winzek, accountant, would be happy to eat your food. Terry, thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain today, and thank you for growing food for our country.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my passion and my life.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.